Mrs. Grogan was in favor of increasing Melanie's responsibilities. She felt the girl was at the threshold of a change. She might either rise above her own bitterness or descend more deeply into it. It was Nurse Angela who suggested to Dr. Larch that Melanie might be of use.
"Of more use, you mean?" Dr. Larch asked.
"Right," Nurse Angela said, but Dr. Larch didn't appreciate anyone imitating the speech habits of Homer Wells. He gave Nurse Angela such a look that she never said "right" again. He also didn't appreciate the suggestion that Melanie could be taught to replace Homer, not even in usefulness. Nurse Edna took up Melanie's cause. "If she were a boy, Wilbur," Nurse Edna said, "you would already have given her more to do." "The hospital is connected to the boys' division," Larch said. "It's impossible to keep what's happening here a secret from the boys, but the girls are another matter," he concluded weakly.
"Melanie knows what's happening here," Nurse Angela said.
Wilbur Larch knew he was cornered. He was also angry at Homer Wells. He had given the boy permission to extend his time away from St. Cloud's as long as possible, but he hadn't expected he wouldn't hear from Homer, not a word, in nearly 6 weeks.
"I don't know that I have the patience to work with a teenager anymore," Larch said peevishly.
"I think Melanie is 24 or 25, Mrs. Grogan said. "How could someone that old still be in an orphanage?" Larch wondered.
"The same way that I can still be here," he answered himself. "Who else would take the job? Who else would take Melanie?"
"All right. Let's ask her if she's interested," Larch said. He dreaded the meeting with Melanie. He couldn't help himself, but he blamed her for whatever sullenness had crept into Homer's personality, and the rebellion Homer had manifested toward him recently. Larch knew he was being unfair, and this made him feel guilty. He began to answer the mail. There was a long, albeit businesslike, letter from Olive Worthington, and a check, a rather sizable donation to the orphanage. Mrs. Worthington said she was happy her son had been so taken by the good work at St. Cloud's that he'd seen fit to bring one of Dr. Larch's boys home with him. It was fine with the Worthingtons that Homer stayed through the summer. They frequently hired schoolboy help, and she was frankly grateful that her son Wally had the opportunity to mingle with someone his own age, but of less fortunate circumstances. Olive Worthington wanted Larch to know that she and her husband thought Homer was a fine boy, polite and a good worker, and that he seemed altogether a sobering influence on Wally. She concluded that she hoped Wally might even learn the value of a day's work from his proximity to Homer, and that Homer had clearly profited from a rigorous education. She based this judgment on Homer's ability to learn the apple business, as if he were used to more demanding studies. Olive wanted Dr. Larch to know that Homer had requested to be paid in the form of a monthly donation to St. Cloud's, minus only what she fairly judged were his expenses. Since he shared a room with Wally and could fit into Wally's clothes, and since he ate his meals with the Worthington family, Olive said the boy's expenses were minimal. She was delighted that her son had such manly and honorable company for the summer, and she was pleased to have the opportunity to contribute what little she could to the well-being of the orphans of St. Cloud's. "The kids," Olive said, it was how she referred to Wally and Candy, "tell me you're doing great things there. They're so happy they stumbled upon you." Wilbur Larch could tell that Olive Worthington didn't know she had an accomplished obstetrician tending to her apple trees, and he grumbled to himself about the rigorous education he felt had been quite wasted on Homer Wells, given his present occupation. But Dr. Larch calmed himself sufficiently to compose a cordial, albeit formal, letter in response to Mrs. Worthington. Her donation was very gratefully received, and he was glad that Homer Wells was representing his upbringing at St. Cloud's in so positive a manner. He would expect no less of the boy, which Mrs. Worthington might be so kind as to tell him. Also, that it would be nice if Homer would write. Dr. Larch was happy that there was such healthy summer employment for Homer. The boy would be missed at St. Cloud's, where he had always been of use, but Larch emphasized his pleasure at Homer's good fortune. He congratulated Olive Worthington on the good manners and the generosity of her son. He said he would welcome those kids back at St. Cloud's any time. What luck for everyone that they had stumbled upon the orphanage. Wilbur Larch gritted his teeth and tried to imagine a harder place to stumble upon than St. Cloud's.
He managed a supreme effort at concentration and proceeded with the part of the letter he had waited more than a month to write.
"There is one thing I must tell you about Homer Wells," Wilbur Larch wrote. "There is a problem with his heart," the doctor wrote. He elaborated. He was more careful than he'd been when he discussed Homer's heart defect with Wally and Candy. He tried to be as precise but as elusive as he knew he'd eventually have to be when he described the ailment to Homer Wells. His letter to Olive Worthington about Homer's heart was a kind of warm-up exercise. He was sowing seeds, an infuriating phrase, but he found himself thinking it, ever since his inheritance of the station master's catalogs. He wanted Homer treated with kid gloves, as they say in Maine. Olive Worthington had mentioned that Homer was taking driving lessons from Wally and swimming lessons from Candy, the latter in the Haven Club's heated pool. The latter, swimming lessons from that girl, made Wilbur Larch growl, and he concluded his cautionary advice about Homer's heart with the suggestion that Homer take it easy with the swimming. Dr. Larch did not share Olive Worthington's opinion that every boy should know how to drive and swim. Dr. Larch could do neither. "Here in St. Cloud's," he wrote to himself, "it is imperative to have good obstetrical procedure and to be able to perform a dilatation and curettage. In other parts of the world, they learn how to drive and swim." He showed Olive Worthington's letter to Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, who both wept over it. They were of the opinion that Mrs. Worthington sounded charming and warm and intelligent. But Larch grumbled how it was strange that Mr. Worthington was so little in view. What was the matter with him? "What's his wife running the farm for?" Larch asked his nurses, who both scolded him for his readiness to assume there was something wrong whenever a woman was in charge of anything. They reminded him that he had an appointment with Melanie. Melanie had been working herself into a proper state of mind for her meeting with Dr. Larch. She prepared herself by lying in her bed and reading over and over again the inscription she had written in the stolen copy of Little Dorrit. "To Homer Sunshine Wells, for the promise you made me, love Melanie." Then she tried, again and again, to begin the book through her angry tears. The image of the staring, blazing sun in Marseille, the oppressive glare, was both dazzling and mystifying to Melanie. What experience did she have to help her comprehend a sun of that brightness? And the coincidence of so much sunshine, considering her nickname for Homer Wells, was too much for her. She read, got lost, began again, got lost again. She grew angrier and angrier. Then she looked in her canvas bag of toilet articles and saw that the horn-rim barret, which Mary Agnes had stolen from Candy, and which Melanie had snatched out of Mary Agnes's hair and taken for herself, had been stolen again. She marched to Mary Agnes Cork's bed and retrieved the elegant barrette from under Mary Agnes's pillow. Melanie's hair was cropped too short for her to be able to use the barrette, which she was not exactly sure how to use anyway. She jammed it into her jeans pocket. This was uncomfortable. Her jeans were so tight. She went into the girls' shower room, where Mary Agnes Cork was washing her hair, and she turned the hot water up so hot that Mary Agnes was nearly scalded. Mary Agnes flung herself out of the shower. She lay red and writhing on the floor, where Melanie twisted her arm behind her back and then stepped with all her weight on Mary Agnes's shoulder. Melanie didn't mean to break anything. She was repelled by the sound of Mary Agnes's collarbone giving way, and she stepped quickly away from the younger girl, whose naked body turned from very red to very white. She lay on the shower room floor, shivering and moaning, not daring to move. "Get dressed and I'll take you to the hospital," Melanie said. "You broke something." Mary Agnes trembled.
"I can't move," she whispered.
"I didn't mean to," Melanie said, "but I told you to keep out of my stuff."
"Your hair's too short," Mary Agnes said. "You can't wear it anyway."
"You want me to break something else?" Melanie asked the girl. Mary Agnes tried to shake her head, but she stopped.
"I can't move," she repeated.
When Melanie bent over her to help her up, Mary Agnes screamed, "Don't touch me!" "Suit yourself," Melanie said, leaving her there. "Just keep out of my stuff." In the lobby of the girls' division, on her way to her meeting with Dr. Larch, Melanie told Mrs. Grogan that Mary Agnes had broken something.
Mrs. Grogan naturally assumed that Melanie meant that Mary Agnes had broken a lamp, or a window, or even a bed.
"How are you liking the book, dear?" Mrs. Grogan asked Melanie, who always carried Little Dorrit with her. She'd not been able to get past the first page.
"It starts kind of slow," said Melanie. When she got to Nurse Angela's office, where Dr. Larch was waiting for her, she was slightly out of breath and sweating.
"What's the book?" Dr. Larch asked her.
"Little Dorrit by Charles Dickens," Melanie said. She felt the barrette bite into her leg when she sat down.
"Where'd you get it?" Dr. Larch asked her.
"It was a gift," Melanie said, which was not exactly a lie.
"That's nice," said Wilbur Larch.
Melanie shrugged.
"It starts kind of slow," she said.
They eyed each other for a moment, cautiously. Larch smiled a little. Melanie tried to smile, but she was unsure how this looked on her face, so she stopped. She shifted in the chair. The barrette in her pocket hurt a little less.
"He's not coming back, is he?" Melanie asked Dr. Larch, who regarded her with the respect and wariness you feel for someone who has read your mind.
"He has a summer job," Larch said. "Of course, some other opportunity might develop."
Melanie shrugged.
"He might go to school, I suppose," she said.
"Oh, I hope so," Larch said.
"I suppose you want him to be a doctor," Melanie said.
Larch shrugged.
It was his turn to feign indifference.
"If he wants to be," he said.
"I broke someone's arm once," Melanie said. "Or maybe it was something in the chest."
"The chest?" Larch asked. "When did you do this?"
"Not long ago," Melanie said. "Pretty recently. I didn't mean to."
"How did it happen?" Dr. Larch asked her.
"I twisted her arm behind her back. She was on the floor. And then I stepped on her shoulder. The same shoulder of the arm I twisted."
"Ouch," said Dr. Larch.
"I heard it," Melanie said. "Her arm or her chest."
"Perhaps her collarbone," Larch suggested.
Given the position, he guessed it would be the collarbone.
"Well, whatever it was, I heard it," Melanie said.
"How did that make you feel?" Wilbur Larch asked Melanie, who shrugged.
"I don't know," Melanie said. "Sick, I guess, but strong," she added.
"Sick and strong," she said.
"Perhaps you'd like to have more to do," Larch asked her.
"Here?"
Melanie asked.
"Well, here, yes," Larch said. "I could find more things for you to do here, more important things. Of course, I could also inquire for you about jobs. Outside, I mean. Away from here."
"You want me to go or do more chores, is that it?"
"I don't want you to do anything you don't want to do. You told me you didn't want to leave once, and I'll never force you. It's just that I thought you might be looking for a change."
"You don't like how I read, huh?" Melanie asked. "Is that it?"
"No," Dr. Larch said. "I want you to keep reading, but that's only one of the things you might do here."
"You want me to do what Homer Wells did?"
"Homer did a lot of studying," Dr. Larch said. "Perhaps you could assist Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna and me. Perhaps you'd be interested in just observing, to see if you liked it."
"I think it's sick," Melanie said.
"You disapprove?" Larch asked,
but Melanie looked genuinely puzzled.
"What?" she asked.
"You don't believe we should perform the abortions, is that it?"
Larch asked.
"You don't believe in terminating a birth and aborting the fetus?"
Melanie shrugged.
"I just think it would make me sick," she repeated.
"Delivering babies, yuck," she said.
"And cutting babies out of people, yuck again."
Larch was confused.
"But it's not that you think it's wrong," he asked.
"What's wrong about it?" she asked him.
"I think it's sick. Blood, people leaking stuff out of their bodies, ick," Melanie said.
"It smells bad around here," she added, meaning the hospital air, the aura of ether, the scent of old blood.
Wilbur Larch stared at Melanie and thought, "Why, she's just a big child. She's a baby thug."
"I don't want to work around the hospital," Melanie said flatly. "I'll rake leaves or something. Stuff like that is okay if you want me to work more for my food or something."
"I want you to be happier than you are, Melanie," Dr. Larch said cautiously.
He felt miserable for how neglected the creature before him was.
"Happier?" said Melanie. She gave a little jump in her chair, and the stolen barrette dug into her.
"You must be stupid or crazy."
Dr. Larch wasn't shocked. He nodded, considering the possibilities. He heard Mrs. Grogan calling him from the hall outside the dispensary.
"Dr. Larch! Dr. Larch!" she called.
"Wilbur," she added, which gave Nurse Edna a tremor, because she felt a certain possessiveness regarding the use of that name.
"Mary Agnes has broken her arm."
Larch stared at Melanie, who for the first time managed to smile.
"You said this happened not too long ago?" Larch asked her.
"I said pretty recently," Melanie admitted. Larch went into the dispensary, where he examined Mary Agnes's collarbone, which was broken. Then he instructed Nurse Angela to prepare the child for X-ray.
"I slipped on the shower room floor," Mary Agnes moaned. "It was real wet."
"Melanie," Dr. Larch called. Melanie was hanging around in the hall. "Melanie, would you like to observe how we set a broken bone?" Melanie walked into the dispensary, which was a small, crowded area, especially with Nurse Edna and Mrs. Grogan standing there, and with Nurse Angela leading Mary Agnes away for her X-ray. Seeing everyone together, Larch realized how old and frail he and his colleagues looked alongside Melanie.
"Would you like to participate in the setting of a broken bone, Melanie?"
Larch asked the sturdy and imposing young woman.
"Nope," Melanie said. "I got things to do."
She waved the copy of Little Dorrit a trifle threateningly.
"And I gotta look at what I'm gonna read tonight," she added.
She went back to the girls' division, to her window there, while Dr. Larch set Mary Agnes's collarbone. Melanie tried again to comprehend the power of the sun in Marseille. "The very dust was scorched brown," she read to herself, "and something quivered in the atmosphere as if the air itself were panting."
"Oh, sunshine," she thought, "why didn't you take me anywhere? It wouldn't have to have been to France, although that would have been nice."
She daydreamed as she read, and therefore she missed the transition between the universal stare of the sun in Marseille and the atmosphere of the prison in the same town. Suddenly she discovered she was in the prison. "A prison taint was on everything," she read, "like a well, like a vault, like a tomb. The prison had no knowledge of the brightness outside." She stopped reading. She left Little Dorrit on her pillow. She stripped a pillowcase off a bed neater than her own, and into the pillowcase she stuffed her canvas bag of toilet articles and some clothes. She also put Jane Eyre in the bag. In Mrs. Grogan's rather spartan room, Melanie had no difficulty locating Mrs. Grogan's purse. She robbed Mrs. Grogan of her money, there wasn't much, and also took Mrs. Grogan's heavy winter coat. In the summer, the coat would be useful if she had to sleep on the ground. Mrs. Grogan was still at the hospital, worrying about Mary Agnes Cork's collarbone. Melanie would have liked to say goodbye to Mrs. Grogan, even after robbing her, but she knew the train schedule by heart. Actually, she knew it by ear. The sound of every arrival and departure reached her window. At the train station, she bought a ticket only as far as Livermore Falls. She knew that even the new and stupid young station master would be able to remember that, and he would tell Dr. Larch and Mrs. Grogan that Melanie had gone to Livermore Falls. She also knew that once she was on the train, she could purchase a ticket to some place much farther away than Livermore Falls. "Can I afford Portland?" she wondered. It was the coast that she would need to explore eventually, because below the Cadillac's gold monogram on that red delicious apple, inscribed, also in gold, against the vivid green background of the apple leaf, she had been able to read Ocean View Orchards. That had to be within sight of the coast, and the Cadillac had a main license plate. It mattered not to Melanie that there were thousands of miles of coastline in the state of Maine. As her train pulled away from St. Cloud's, Melanie said to herself, so vehemently that her breath fogged the window and obscured the abandoned buildings in that forsaken town from her view, "I'm gonna find you, sunshine." Dr. Larch tried to comfort Mrs. Grogan, who said she wished only that she'd had more money for Melanie to steal. "And my coat's not waterproof," Mrs. Grogan complained.
She should have a real raincoat in this state. Dr. Larch tried to reassure Mrs. Grogan. He asserted that Melanie was not a little girl.
She's 24 or 25, Larch reminded Mrs. Grogan.
I think her heart is broken, said Mrs. Grogan miserably. Dr. Larch pointed out that Melanie had taken Jane Eyre with her. He accepted this as a hopeful sign. Wherever Melanie went, she would not be without guidance. She would not be without love, without faith. She had a good book with her. If only she'll keep reading it and reading it, Larch thought. The book that Melanie had left behind was a puzzle to both Mrs. Grogan and Dr. Larch. They read the dedication to Homer, Sunshine Wells, which touched Mrs. Grogan deeply. Neither of them had any luck reading Little Dorrit, either. Mrs. Grogan never would get to the villainous prison. The staring sun in Marseille outstared her. It was too powerfully blinding. Dr. Larch, who, in the absence of Homer Wells and Melanie, resumed his responsibilities as the nightly reader to both the boys' and the girls' divisions, attempted to read Little Dorrit to the girls. Wasn't the main character a girl? But the contrast between the scorched air in the Marseille sun and the tainted air in the Marseille prison created such a powerful sleeplessness among the girls that Larch was relieved to give up on the book in Chapter 3, which had an unfortunate title for orphans, Home. He began the description of London on a Sunday evening, hounded by church bells. "Melancholy streets in a penitential garb of soot," read Dr. Larch. And then he stopped. "We need no more melancholy here," he thought. "Wouldn't we rather wait and read Jane Eyre again?" Dr. Larch asked. The girls nodded eagerly. Knowing that the beautiful boy with the face of a benefactor must have a mother with the heart for benefiting those who existed in, as she had written herself, less fortunate circumstances, Dr. Larch wrote Olive Worthington. "My dear Mrs. Worthington, here in St. Cloud's, we depend on our few luxuries and imagine and pray they will last forever. If you would be so kind, please tell Homer that his friend Melanie has left us, her whereabouts are unknown, and that she took with her our only copy of Jane Eyre. The orphans in the girls' division were accustomed to hearing this book read aloud. In fact, Homer used to read to them. If Homer could discover a replacement copy, the little girls and I would remain in his debt. In other parts of the world, there are bookshops." Thus, Larch knew, he had accomplished two things. Olive Worthington herself would send him a replacement Jane Eyre. He doubted very much that it would be a second-hand copy. And Homer would receive the important message. Melanie was out. She was loose in the world. Larch thought that Homer should know this, that he might want to keep an eye open for her. As for Little Dorrit, Nurse Edna read Melanie's inscription and wept. She was not a big reader, Edna. She penetrated no farther than the inscription. Nurse Angela had already been defeated by Dickens. She blinked once, briefly, at the sun in Marseille and failed to turn the page. For years, Candy's unread copy would rest in Nurse Angela's office. Those nervously awaiting interviews with Dr. Larch would pick up Little Dorrit as they would pick up a magazine, restlessly, inattentively. Larch rarely kept anyone waiting past the first glare of the sun, and most preferred to scan the odd assortment of catalogues, the seeds, the fishing equipment, the stupendous undergarments, the latter modeled in an otherworldly way, on those headless, legless, armless stumps that were the period's version of the standard dressmaker's dummy. "In other parts of the world," Dr. Larch began once, "they have nursing bras." But this thought led him nowhere. It fell as a fragment into the many, many pages of A Brief History of St. Cloud's. Little Dorrit seemed condemned to an unread life. Even Candy, who replaced her stolen copy, and always wondered what happened to it, would never finish the book, although it was required reading for her class. She, too, could not navigate past the sun's initial assault on her senses. She suspected her difficulty with the book arose from its power to remind her of her discomfort on the long journey to and from St. Cloud's, and of what had happened to her there. She would especially remember the ride back to the coast, how she'd stretched out in the back seat, with only the dash lights of the Cadillac and the glowing ash end of Wally's cigarette shining bright but small in the surrounding darkness. The tires of the big car hummed soothingly. She was grateful for Homer's presence because she didn't have to talk, or listen to, Wally. She couldn't even hear what Wally and Homer were saying to each other. "Life stories," Wally would say to her later. "That kid's had quite a life, but I should let him tell you." The drone of their conversation was as rhythmic as the tire song, but, as weary as she was, she couldn't sleep. She thought about how much she was bleeding. Maybe more than she should be, she worried. Between St. Cloud's and the coast, she asked Wally 3 times to stop the car. She kept checking her bleeding and changing the pad. Dr. Larch had given her quite a few pads, but would there be enough, and how much bleeding was too much? She looked at the back of Homer's head. If it's worse tomorrow, or as bad the next day, she thought, I'll have to ask him. When Wally went to the men's room and left them alone in the car, Homer spoke to her, but he didn't turn around. "You're probably having cramps, about as bad as you get with your period," he said. "You're probably bleeding, but not like you bleed during your period. Nothing near what it is at your heaviest time. If the stains on the pad are only 2 or 3 inches in diameter, that's okay, it's expected."
"Thank you," Candy whispered.
"The bleeding should taper off tomorrow and get much lighter the next day. If you're worried, you should ask me," he said.
"Okay," Candy said.
She felt so strange that a boy her own age should know this much about her. "I've never seen a lobster," said Homer Wells, to change the subject, to allow her to be the authority.
"Then you've never eaten one either," Candy said cheerfully.
"I don't know if I want to eat something I've never seen," Homer said, and Candy laughed. She was laughing when Wally got back in the car.
"We're talking about lobsters," Homer explained.
"Oh, they're hilarious," Wally said, and all three of them laughed.
"Wait till you see one," Candy said to Homer. "He's never seen one," she told Wally.
"They're even funnier when you see them," Wally said. Candy's laughter hurt her. She stopped very suddenly, but Homer laughed more.
"And wait till they try to talk to you," Wally added. "Lobsters really break me up every time they try to talk."
When he and Wally stopped laughing, Homer said,
"I've never seen the ocean, you know."
"Candy, did you hear that?"
Wally asked. But Candy had released herself with her brief laughter. She was sound asleep.
"You've never seen the ocean?" Wally asked Homer.
"That's right," said Homer Wells.
"Well, that's not funny," said Wally seriously.
"Right," Homer said. A little later, Wally said, "You want to drive for a while?"
"I don't know how to drive," Homer said.
"Really?" Wally asked.
And later still, it was almost midnight, Wally asked,
"Have you ever been with a girl? Made love to one, you know?"
But Homer Wells had also felt released. He had laughed out loud with his new friends. The young but veteran insomniac had fallen asleep. Would Wally have been surprised to know that Homer hadn't laughed out loud with friends before, either? And possibly Homer would have had difficulty characterizing his relationship with Melanie as a relationship based on making love. What a new sense of security Homer had felt in that moment of laughter with friends in the enclosed dark of the moving car. And what a sense of freedom the car itself gave to him. Its seemingly effortless journeying was a wonder to Homer Wells, for whom the idea of motion, not to mention the sense of change, was accomplished only rarely and only with enormous strife.
"Candy?" Wally whispered.
And a little later he whispered,
"Homer?"
He rather liked the idea of steering these two through the blackened world, of being their guide through the night, and their protector from whatever lay just beyond the headlights' reach.
"Well, buddy," Wally said to the sleeping Homer Wells, "it's high time you had some fun."
Wilbur Larch, almost a month later, still waiting to hear from Homer Wells and too proud to write the first letter, wondered about the fun Homer was having. "Swimming lessons," he thought. "What does one wear for swimming in a heated pool? How do they heat the pool, and how much do they heat it?" In 1940-something, the pool at the Haven Club was the first heated swimming pool in Maine. Although Raymond Kendall thought it was ridiculous to heat water for purposes other than cooking and bathing, he had invented the heating mechanism for the Haven Club pool. It was just an exercise in mechanics for Ray.
"If you learn to swim in the ocean," Ray told Homer, "you'll learn the proper response for a body to make to all that water."
"But you don't know how to swim, Daddy," Candy said.
"That's what I mean," he said, winking at Homer Wells. You set foot in the ocean, a fall in, you'll have enough sense never to set foot in it again. It's too cold.
Homer liked Candy's father, perhaps because surgery is the mechanics of medicine, and Homer's early training had been surgical. He made instant identification with the machinery with which Ray Kendall worked, both the apple farm equipment and the mechanisms for hauling the lobsters and keeping them alive. Contrary to Wally's promise to him regarding the humor of lobsters, Homer was unamused by his first look at the creatures. They crammed the tank in Ray Kendall's lobster pound, crawling over each other, their claws pegged shut so that they wielded them underwater like ineffective clubs. Homer knew he had seen a good reason for learning how to swim. If one ever fell in the sea, one wouldn't want to fall to the bottom where these creatures lived. It was some while before Homer learned that the lobsters did not cover the ocean's floor in such density as they occupied the tank. The first question that leaped to his mind did not concern how a lobster ate or how it multiplied, but why it lived at all.
"There's got to be something that picks up what's lying around," Ray Kendall advised Homer.
"It's the garbage monster of the ocean's floor," Wally said, laughing. He always laughed when he discussed lobster.
"The seagull cleans up the shore," Ray Kendall said. "The lobster cleans up the bottom."
"Lobsters and seagulls," Candy said, "they take what's left over." Wilbur Larch might have observed that they were given the orphan share. This occurred to Homer Wells, who discovered he could spend time watching lobsters with dread and seagulls with pleasure, while watching both with awe and respect. Years later, when she became the proud owner of the first TV set in Hart's Rock, Olive Worthington would say that Homer Wells was the only person who ever pulled up a chair and sat down in front of the tank in Ray Kendall's lobster pound, as if he were watching the news on television. Homer pulled lobster pots with Candy's father on Sundays, not for money, but to be out on the water and to be around Ray. 6 days a week, Homer worked with Wally in the orchards. The ocean was visible from only one of Ocean View's several orchards, but the presence of the sea was felt throughout the farm, especially in the early morning fog, and when a sea breeze freshened the summer heat, and because of the seagulls who circled inland and occasionally perched in the trees. They were more partial to blueberries than to apples, but their presence was an irritation to Olive, who from her early years among the clams had no love for the raucous birds, and who fought with the gulls over the small plot of blueberries she was cultivating. The blueberries were protected with low-hung nets, but the gulls and the crows were smart enough to walk under the nets. Among orphans, thought Homer Wells, seagulls are superior to crows, not in intelligence or in personality, he observed, but in the freedom they possess and cherish. It was in looking at seagulls that it first occurred to Homer Wells that he was free. Wilbur Larch knew that freedom was an orphan's most dangerous illusion, and when he finally heard from Homer, he scanned the oddly formal letter, which was disappointing in its lack of detail. Regarding illusions and all the rest, there was simply no evidence. "I'm learning to swim," wrote Homer Wells.
"I know, I know. Tell me about it," thought Wilbur Larch.
"I do better at driving," Homer added. "Mrs. Worthington is very nice." "I could have guessed that," thought Wilbur Larch. "She knows everything about apples."
"Candy's father is very nice, too," Homer Wells wrote to Dr. Larch. "He takes me out in his lobster boat, and he's teaching me how an engine works."
"Do you wear a life jacket on the lobster boat?" Wilbur Larch wanted to know. "Do you think an engine is so special? I could teach you how the heart works," thought Wilbur Larch, his own heart teaching him about itself, and much more than its function as a muscle.
"Candy and Wally are wonderful," Homer wrote. "I go everywhere with them. I sleep in Wally's room. I wear his clothes. It's great that we're the same size, although he is stronger. Candy and Wally are getting married one day, and they want to have lots of children."
"Tell me about the swimming lessons," thought Wilbur Larch. "Watch out for the swimming lessons."
"Poor Mr. Worthington. Everyone calls him Senior," Homer wrote.
"Aha," thought Wilbur Larch.
"So something isn't perfect, is it? What's poor about Mr. Worthington?"
He asked Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna what they thought of the name Senior. They agreed it was different.
"It sounds stupid to me," said Wilbur Larch. Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna told him he wasn't being fair. The boy had departed with his blessings, more with his encouragement. They agreed Homer could have written something and sent it sooner than 6 weeks, but they argued that this indicated only how happy he was, how busy and how glad to be busy, too. And what experience did Homer Wells have with writing letters,
or with writing of any kind, they wanted to know.
"You want him to be a doctor, Wilbur," Nurse Edna said, "but it's his life."
"Did you expect him to be a writer, too?" Nurse Angela chimed in.
"And never get married?" Nurse Edna asked dangerously.
"I expect him to be of use," thought Wilbur Larch tiredly. "And I want him with me." This last wish he knew was unfair. In the dispensary, he rested from the summer heat. All that glass and steel were somehow cooling, and the ether fumes evaporated more slowly in the humidity. He seemed to be traveling both farther away and for longer in his ether dreams now. When he came out of the ether, he seemed to come out of it more slowly. "I'm getting older," he repeated to himself. A beautiful and untouched copy of Jane Eyre arrived from Mrs. Worthington, and Wilbur Larch read more spiritedly to the girls. The newness of the story refreshed him. It even enlivened his weary approach to the sad conclusion of Great Expectations. He never believed the part about Pip and Estella being happy ever after. He never believed that about anyone. A pattern of correspondence slowly developed between Wilbur Larch and Homer Wells. Homer would sketch the barest facts of his life in Hart's Rock and Hart's Haven. He would give Dr. Larch a glimpse, like the far-off visibility of the ocean from the one orchard at Ocean View where sighting the sea was possible. He would send Dr. Larch a page, maybe 2 pages, once a week or every other week. To this speck on the horizon, Dr. Larch would respond with the full orchestration of the written word. Questions, which would never be answered, regarding the specificity of what was lacking in Homer's last letter. "What precisely is the matter with Mr. Worthington?" And a flood of details concerning the daily grimness of St. Cloud's. As much as Dr. Larch disdained the gossipy instinct of Snowy Meadows for keeping up with the orphanage, Dr. Larch provided Homer Wells with a virtual alumni newsletter and with a calendar of hospital and social events. His letters to Homer Wells were longer than his longest entries in A Brief History of St. Cloud's, and they were written and mailed the day following Dr. Larch's receipt of the most minimal scrawl from Homer. "You can't expect the boy to keep up with you, Wilbur," Nurse Edna advised Dr. Larch. "You can't expect him to compete with you," Nurse Angela said. "What the hell is wrong with this Senior Worthington character?" Dr. Larch asked. "Homer said it was a drinking problem, Wilbur," Nurse Edna reminded him. "What do you want to know, the brand of hooch?" Nurse Angela asked. But what Wilbur Larch expected from his young apprentice was only what he thought he had taught him. Clinical analysis, the exact definition of characteristics associated with light, medium, or heavy drinking. "Are we talking about a guy who makes a fool out of himself at parties?" Wilbur Larch wondered. "Or is this something severe and chronic?" Because Homer Wells had never seen a drunk before, he was, at first, even more easily deceived by Senior Worthington's appearance than Senior's immediate family and friends were. And Homer was as ready as they were to accept Senior's deterioration in cognition as the natural result of alcoholism. A man long admired in Hart's Rock and Hart's Haven, especially for the sweetness of his disposition, Senior had become short-tempered, irritable, and even aggressive on occasion. Following the incident with the grasshopper pie, Olive wouldn't allow him to go to the Haven Club without her. Senior had plastered an entire grasshopper pie against the chest of a nice, young lifeguard, and needed to be restrained, then, from further smearing the pale green ingredients on the rump of a nice young waitress. "He was showing off," Senior said of the lifeguard. "He was just standing there," he explained. "And the waitress?" Olive asked. Senior appeared confused and began to cry.
"I thought she was someone else," he said faintly.
Olive had taken him home. Wally had made up to the waitress. It was Candy who had charmed and reassured the lifeguard. Senior became lost driving to other than routine places. Olive never allowed him to have the car unless Wally or Homer went with him. Eventually, he became lost trying to get to familiar places. Homer had to lead him back to Ocean View from Ray Kendall's lobster pound. Even Homer, who was unfamiliar with a network of small roads to and from the coast, could tell that Senior had made a wrong turn. Senior made terrible mistakes in any complex motor task. While cleaning the carburetor for the Cadillac, a simple job which Ray Kendall had demonstrated for him many times, Senior inhaled the gas and little carbon particles in the tubes.
He sucked in instead of blowing out. Senior's recent memory was so severely impaired that he wandered for an hour through his own bedroom, unable to dress himself. He constantly confused his sock drawer with a drawer for Olive's underwear. One morning he became so enraged at his mistake that he appeared at the breakfast table with each foot tightly tied up in a bra. Normally friendly to Homer and tender to Wally and Olive, he shouted an accusation at Wally that his own son was wearing his father's socks, which he had taken without his father's permission. And he ranted at Olive for turning his domicile into a foundling home without asking his permission regarding that. "You'd be better off in St. Cloud's than in this house of thieves," he told Homer. Upon saying this, Senior Worthington burst into tears and begged Homer's forgiveness. He put his head on Homer's shoulder and wept. "My brain is sending poison to my heart," he told Homer, who thought it strange that Senior didn't seem to drink before the late afternoon, yet he appeared to be drunk nearly all the time. Sometimes it went like this. Senior would not drink for 3 days, a part of him able to observe that his silliness flourished no less ardently. Yet he would forget to make this point to Olive, or to anyone else, until he'd broken down and had a drink. By the time he remembered to say he had not been drinking, he was drunk. "Why do I forget everything?" he wondered, and then forgot it. Yet his long-range memory was quite intact. He sang college songs to Olive, the lines of which she herself was unable to remember, and he sweetly recalled for her the romantic evenings of their courtship. He told Wally stories of Wally as a baby. He entertained Homer by cheerfully recounting the planting of some of the older tree orchards, including the lone orchard from which the sea was visible. "It was where I wanted to build the house, Homer," Senior said. It was lunchtime. Wally and Homer had been suckering in the orchard, stripping the inner limbs off the tree or any new sprouting branches, or suckers, that had turned inward, the ones not reaching out to the sun. Wally had heard the story. He was distracted. He poured some Coca-Cola on an anthill. Suckering exposes as many of the limbs as possible to the light. It lets the light come through the tree. "You don't allow an apple tree to grow every which way," Wally had explained to Homer.
"Like a boy,"
Senior had shouted, laughing.
"Olive thought it was too windy for a house here," Senior told Homer. "Women are disturbed by the wind more than men are disturbed by it," Senior confided. "That's a fact. Anyway," he paused. He gestured to the sea as if it were a far-off audience, and he meant to include it by the sweep of his hand. He turned to the apple trees around them. They were a slightly more intimate audience, paying closer attention. "The wind," he started to say, and paused again, perhaps waiting for the wind to contribute something. "The house," he started to say. "You can see this orchard from the second floor of our house. Did you know that?" he asked Homer. "Right," Homer said. Wally's room was on the second floor. From Wally's window you could see the orchard from which the sea was visible, but the sea wasn't visible from Wally's window, or from any other window in the house.
"I called the whole place Ocean View," Senior explained, "because I thought the house was going to be here. Right here," he repeated.
He looked down at the foaming Coca-Cola that Wally was slowly pouring into the anthill.
"You use poison oats and poison corn to kill the mice," Senior said. "It stinks."
Wally looked up at him. Homer nodded.
"You scatter the stuff for the field mice, but you have to find the holes and put it in the tunnels if you want to kill the pine mice," he said.
"We know, Pop," Wally said softly.
"Field mice are the same as meadow mice," Senior explained to Homer, who had already been told this.
"Right," Homer said.
"Meadow mice girdle a tree, and pine mice eat the roots," Senior recited from his distant memory.
Wally stopped pouring the Coke on the anthill. He and Homer didn't know why Senior had joined them for their lunch break. They'd been suckering in the ocean orchard all morning, and Senior had just shown up. He was driving the old Jeep that didn't have any license plates. It was strictly for driving around the orchards.
"Pop," Wally asked him, "what are you doing out here?"
Senior stared blankly at his son. He looked at Homer. He hoped Homer might tell him the answer. He regarded his audience, the apple trees, the far-off ocean.
I wanted to build the house here. Right here, he said to Wally. But your bossy bitch of a have-it-all-her-own-way mother wouldn't let me. She wouldn't let me, the cunt, he cried. Clam-digger cunt! Well-digger pussy! He shouted. He stood up. He looked disoriented. Wally stood up with him. Come on, Pop, he said. I'll drive you home. They took Wally's pickup. Homer followed them in the old Jeep. It was the vehicle he had learned to drive in after Wally had assured him that he couldn't hurt it. Alcohol, thought Homer Wells, it sure can destroy you. Senior had all the other symptoms, too. He was 55. He looked 70. He had periods of paranoia, of grandiosity, of confabulation. His few obnoxious traits, which he'd always had, were exaggerated. In his case, nose-picking, for example. He could explore a nostril for an hour. He put boogers on his pants or on the furniture. Olive's vulgar brother, Bucky Bean, claimed that Senior could have been a well-digger. The way he roots into his snoot, Bucky said, I could use him to dig a well. The Haven Club's lifeguard, whose chest had received the full force of the grasshopper pie, turned out to be not completely mollified. He objected to Candy giving Homer swimming lessons in the shallow end of the pool in the late afternoon. The pool was crowded then, he complained. Swimming lessons were regularly scheduled in the early morning, and he, the lifeguard, regularly administered them for a fee. He was not convinced that he should be flexible about the matter. Homer worked at Ocean View all day, Candy argued. In the late afternoon, when Wally played tennis after work, was the ideal time for Candy to give Homer instructions. Ideal for you, the lifeguard argued with Candy. He had a crush on her, it was plain. It was one thing to be jealous of Wally Worthington, everyone was, but quite another to have to suffer the attentions Candy Kendall gave to the hard luck case from St. Cloud's. At the Haven Club, never in Candy's presence or in the presence of any of the Worthingtons, Homer was referred to not as the foundling or as the orphan, but as the hard luck case from St. Cloud's. Sometimes the Worthingtons' hard luck case was the way it was put. Homer said he wouldn't mind practicing in the Worthingtons' private pool at Ocean View, but it was nice that he and Candy could be at the Haven Club when Wally finished playing tennis. They could then go off together to the beach, to Ray Kendall's dock, to wherever. Also at the Worthingtons' pool there would be Senior to deal with. More and more Olive tried to keep Senior home, away from the Haven Club. She found she could pacify him best by feeding him gin and tonics and keeping him in the pool, floating on a rubber raft. But the real reason it was a bad idea, everyone felt, for Homer to learn to swim in the Worthingtons' unheated pool, was that the cold water might be a shock to his heart. Olive decided that she would take over Homer's lessons from Candy. She knew that the lifeguard at the Haven Club wouldn't dare to complain to her. She and Candy and Wally agreed that the unheated experience might be too severe for Homer. "I don't want to be any trouble for you," Homer said, puzzled and doubtlessly disappointed that the hands under his stomach as he paddled back and forth were Olive's and not Candy's. "It's not too cold for me in your pool, Wally," Homer said. "It's harder to learn when it's cold," Candy said. "Yes, that's right," Olive said. "Well, I want to swim in the ocean as soon as I learn how," Homer told them. "It's a lot colder in the ocean than it is in your pool." "Oh, my," Olive worried. She wrote Dr. Larch about the heart problem, which made Larch feel guilty and slightly trapped. "Actually," he wrote to her, "cold water doesn't provide the kind of shock he was anxious about. The kind of shock associated with an accident, for example a near drowning, was more the kind of shock he felt that Homer must try to avoid." What lies, Larch thought, but he mailed the letter to Mrs. Worthington anyway, and Olive found that Homer learned to swim very rapidly. "He must have been right on the verge of picking it up when I took over from you," she told Candy. But in truth, Homer learned more quickly from Olive because the lessons themselves were not as pleasurable. With Candy, he might never have learned to swim. At least, he could have prolonged it and made the lessons last the rest of the summer. Homer Wells would have made that summer last the rest of his life if he could have. There was so much about his life at Ocean View that made him happy. He was not ashamed that he loved the Worthingtons' wall-to-wall carpeting. He'd come from bare wood walls and many layers of linoleum, between which one could feel the sawdust shift underfoot.
One couldn't claim that the Worthingtons' walls were hung with art, but Homer had not seen pictures on walls before, except the portrait of the pony woman. Even the crowning cuteness of the oil painting of the cat in the flower bed in Wally's bathroom appeared to Homer. And the flower bed wallpaper behind the painting appealed to him, too. What did he know about wallpaper or art? He thought all wallpaper was wonderful. He felt he would never stop loving Wally's room. What did he know about varsity letters and footballs dipped in liquid gold and inscribed with the score of an important game, and tennis trophies, and old yearbooks and the ticket stubs stuck into the molding of the mirror from the first movie Wally took Candy to? What did he know about movies? Wally and Candy took him to one of Maine's first drive-in movies. How could he ever have imagined that? And what did he know about people who came together every day and worked together by apparent choice? His fellow workers at Ocean View were a marvel to Homer Wells. At first, he loved them all. He loved Meanie Hyde the most because Meanie was so friendly and had such fondness for explaining how everything was done, even things that Homer or anyone else could have seen how to do without being told. Homer especially loved listening to Meanie explain the obvious. He loved Meanie Hyde's wife, Florence, and the other women who spent the summer making the apple mart and the cider house ready for the harvest. He loved Big Dot Taft, although the jiggle in the backs of her arms reminded him of Melanie, whom he never thought about, not even when he heard that she had left St. Cloud's. He liked Big Dot Taft's kid sister, Deborah Pettigrew, who was his own age, and pretty, although there was something determined about her chubbiness that suggested she had the capacity for one day becoming as big as Big Dot. Big Dot's husband, Everett Taft, showed Homer all about mowing. You mowed the rows between the trees twice a summer, then you raked and hayed the rows, then you baled the hay and sold it to the dairy farm in Kenneth Corners. You used the loose hay for mulch around the younger trees. At Ocean View, everything was used. Homer liked Ira Titcomb, the beekeeper and the husband of Irene of the wondrous burn scar. It was Ira who explained to Homer about the bees. "They like at least 65 degrees. No wind, no hail, no frost," Ira said. "A bee lives about 30 days and does more work than some men do all their lives. I ain't saying who." "All honey is," said Ira Titcomb, "is fuel for bees." Homer learned that bees prefer dandelions to apple blossoms, which was why you mowed the dandelions down just before you brought the bees into the orchard. He learned why there had to be more than one kind of tree in an orchard for cross-pollinating. The bees had to carry the pollen to one kind of tree, to another. He learned it should be nighttime when you put the hives out in the orchard. At night the bees were asleep, and you could close the little screen door at the slat at the bottom of the box that contained the hive. When you carried the hives, the bees woke up, but they couldn't get out. The hives were light when they were carried off the flatbed trailer and distributed through the orchards, but they were heavy with honey when they had to be picked up and loaded back on the trailer a week later. Sometimes a hive could be too heavy to lift alone. If the hives were jostled, the bees inside began to hum. You could feel them stirring through the wood. If honey had leaked through the slats, a lone bee might get gobbed up in the leaking honey, and that was the only way you could get stung. Once, when Homer hugged a hive to his chest and carefully walked it to the flatbed's edge, he felt a vibration against the taut boards containing the hive. Even in the cool night air, the boards were warm. The activity of the hive generated heat. Like an infection, Homer thought suddenly. He recalled the taut belly of the woman he had saved from convulsions. The thought of the activity in the uterus as producing both a heat and a hardness to the abdomen. How many abdomens had Homer Wells put his hand on before he was 20? "I prefer apple farming," he thought. At St. Cloud's, growth was unwanted even when it was delivered, and the process of birth was often interrupted. Now he was engaged in the business of growing things. What he loved about the life at Ocean View was how everything was of use and that everything was wanted. He even thought he loved Vernon Lynch, although he'd been told how Vernon beat his wife, and Grace Lynch had a way of looking at Homer that did alarm him. He could not tell from her look if it was need or suspicion or simply curiosity that he saw. Grace gave out the kind of look you go on feeling after you've stopped looking back. Vernon Lynch showed Homer how to spray. It was appropriate that Vernon Lynch was in charge of the pesticides, of extermination. "As soon as there's leaves, there's trouble," Vernon told him. "That's in April. You start spraying in April, and you don't stop till the end of August, when you're ready to start picking. You spray every week or 10 days.
You spray for scab and you spray for insects. We got two sprayers here, one's a Hardy and one's a Bean, and both of them hold 500 gallons. You wear the respirator because you don't want to breathe the shit, and the respirator don't do you no good if it don't fit tight. Saying this, Vernon Lynch tightened the respirator around Homer's head. Homer could feel his temples pound. If you don't keep washing out the cloth and the mask, you could choke, Vernon said. He cupped his hand over Homer's mouth and nose. Homer experienced airlessness. And keep your hair covered if you don't want to go bald. Vernon's hand remained clamped over Homer's mouth and nose. And keep the goggles on if you don't want to go blind, he added. Homer considered struggling, decided to conserve his strength, contemplated fainting, wondered if it was true or just an expression that lungs explode. If you get what they call an open wound, like a cut, and the shit gets in there, you could get sterile, said Vernon Lynch. That means no more nasty hard-ons. Homer tapped his shoulder and waved to Vernon as if he were signaling something too complicated to be communicated by normal means. I can't breathe. Hello, I can't breathe. Hello out there. When Homer's knees started to wobble, Vernon ripped the mask off his face, the headstrap raking his ears upward and tangling his hair. Got the picture? Vernon asked. Right, Homer called out, his lungs screaming. He even liked Herb Fowler. He'd been with Herb less than 2 minutes when the prophylactic sailed his way and struck him in the forehead. All Meanie Hyde had said was, Hi, Herb, this here's Homer Wells. He's Wally's pal from St. Cloud's. And Herb had flipped the rubber at Homer. Wouldn't be so many orphans if more people put these on their joints, Herb said. Homer Wells had never seen a prophylactic in a commercial wrapper. The ones that Dr. Larch kept at the hospital, and distributed to many of the women in handfuls, were sealed in something plain and see-through, like wax paper. No brand names adorned them. Dr. Larch was always complaining that he didn't know where all the rubbers were going, but Homer knew that Melanie had helped herself on many occasions. It had been Melanie, of course, who had introduced Homer to prophylactics. Herb Fowler's girlfriend, Louise Toby, was doubtlessly professional in handling Herb's prophylactics. When Homer touched himself, he thought about Squeeze Louise. He imagined her dexterity with a prophylactic, her fast and nimble fingers, the way she held a paintbrush and clenched her teeth, slapping the paint on thick on the Applemart shelves, blowing a lock of her hair off her forehead with a puff of breath that was bitter with cigarettes. Homer didn't allow himself to masturbate when candy was on his mind. He lay not touching himself in Wally's room, with Wally breathing deeply and sleeping peacefully beside him. Whenever Homer did imagine that Candy was sleeping beside him, they were never touching each other intimately. They were just holding tightly to each other in a grip of chaste affection. Nothing genital, as Melanie used to say. Candy smoked, but she was so mannered and exaggerated that she often dropped her cigarette in her lap, jumping up and furiously brushing away the sparks, always laughing. "Oh, what a clod!" she'd cry. If so, thought Homer Wells, only when you're smoking. Louise Toby wolfed in a cigarette. She sucked in a cloud of smoke and blew so little back, Homer wondered where it all went. The older Applemart women were constant smokers, all except Grace Lynch, who had resolved not to part her lips, not for any reason. But Florence and Irene and Big Dot Taft had been smoking so long, they appeared off-handed about it. Only Deborah Pettigrew, Dot's kid sister, smoked with Candy's infrequency and awkwardness. Squeeze Louise smoked with a quick, sure violence that Homer imagined must have been inspired by Herb Fowler's rough-and-ready use of rubbers. In all of Hart's Rock and Hart's Haven, from the briny gurgle of lobstering life to the chlorine security of the Haven Club pool, from the bustle of the making-ready and the apple-mart to the work in the fields, there was nothing that caused Homer a single sharp reminder of St. Cloud's. Nothing until the first rainy day, when they sent him, with a small crew of scrubbers and painters, to the cider house. Nothing about the building from the outside prepared him. On or in various farm vehicles, he had lumbered past it often, a long, thin, one-story, shed-roofed building, in the shape of an arm held at a right angle. In the elbow of the building, where there was a double-door entrance, were the cider mill and the press, the grinder, the pump engine and the grinder engine, and the 1,000-gallon tank. One wing of the building was studded with refrigeration units. It was a cold storage room for the cider.
In the other wing was a small kitchen, beyond which were extended two long rows of iron hospital-style beds, each with its own blanket and pillow. Mattresses were rolled neatly on each of the more than 20 beds. Sometimes a blanket on wire runners enclosed a bed or a section of